finery, and so on. Written by Feather and read by Tiny Pink Mouse. On the subject of jewels and gold, the Empress of Boundless Meloria and Queen of Angrak remained absolutely adamant. She didn't want them. She didn't like them. They were heavy, dead, and gaudy, and she would continue to wear flowers. The imminent collapse of the Malarian economy, due to the way the ladies of the court imitated her, was averted in two ways. For one, every lady once covered in jewels now absolutely demanded the rarest flowers to adorn herself with, and many jewelers found new careers as florists. And for another, some lucky bastard had a clever daughter who noted that you could make flowers out of jewels. In such small ways is the world saved. She also remained adamant on the subject of vast banquets and expensive liquors, in that she did not have a taste for either. Light, refreshing, simple food was all she desired, and intoxication was distasteful to her. Her husband, the Emperor of Boundless Meloria and Overking of Angrak, had been heard to remark that at least he'd have rather fewer greasy, overindulged courtiers if she hewed to that path. And besides, his physician approved of his queen's diet and encouraged him to emulate her in actually eating occasionally. Empress Syrdis even remained firm on the design of her clothing, which remained simple, although, as more than one genially bitter old lady out of the court pointed out, when you happen to be young, slender, and preternaturally gorgeous, you could wear a sack and make it look wonderful. And although simple, the Empress's clothing was certainly not actually cut like a sack. Indeed, it suited her extremely well, and served the purpose of not making her look like an overwrought bird of paradise beside her husband in his customary white linen robe. This white linen robe was generally taken to be a sign of the Emperor's austerity and clarity of mind. But this is only because many people are ignorant of the sheer luxury of truly fine linen, and also of the power of contrast, and the ways in which only the very high indeed can afford to embrace the seemingly low. In only one area had Syrdis, who had been the seeress of Kel, made some surrenders to decadence, and that was in what her gowns were made of. Zakat had made his case through trickery. He did that quite often, although he preferred the word deception to trickery. The former, he said, had a sense of elegance and grace, where the latter suggested a wicked and badly behaved little boy getting away with a prank. Yes, Syrdis had replied levelly when he'd said it to her. That was why she'd used the latter in the first place. But trick or not, his reasoning had been sound. This was Meloria, even more than anything else. Carpets and silk was what they were famous for. And so as a symbol it only befitted the Empress to wear Malarian silk, and walk upon Malarian carpets, and that this shouldn't be a terrible hardship, as the ladies of the court imitated the Empress, and not the other way around, so she could choose her own manner of wearing said Malarian silk to impress upon the court. Syrdis had sighed, and consented. To say that the Book of the Heavens was close to her now was an oversimplification. All that had been taken from her had been the near unbearable weight of her people's soul, the spirit and intelligence of every learned Dahl who had ever lived and, in some ways, ever would. That bond was not broken as such. Such a thing couldn't break. But it had diffused, both for her and for the rest of her people. And so she no longer carried everything they had ever been or would be. It meant there were no skills in her head but her own, no knowledge but what she remembered, no vision except that of her own heart, and that was indeed far less than had flooded her before. However, just because it isn't a forest fire doesn't mean that a lantern carries no flame. She had always known this path might be open to her, but in a life holding the weight of the universe There had been no time waste in preparing herself for the chance that she might choose the way that led, as it had, to being an empress. Because of that, trying to maintain now the balance of what the world, or at least the empire, needed of her, and how much change she could encompass without giving into the urge to scream and, love aside, duty aside, vision aside, running back to Kell as fast as she could was difficult. She didn't. Cyrodiil knew where that would end. Walking amongst the powers of the world, one took up duties greater than oneself, and she was used to this. To abandon Zagat now, even putting aside her own remorse, would damage the empire and all the people who dwelt within, and had suffered so much these past years already. She wouldn't do it. But the day she looked at herself in the mirror, in jewels and gold and sick from unnecessary feasting, wrapped all up in the show of power that, yet, was so much less than she had once held. That day she would no longer be Cyrodiil, and that was a thought she couldn't stand. In the end, though, to the silk she had sighed and consented, and had been too tired to bother trying to guess what lay behind Zagat's private, triumphant smile when he sent for all the servants who would perform the illusion of creating elegance out of nothing. She allowed herself to be measured and then said very firmly, "I am going to bathe," and hid in her baths, sending away even Hela, her Delatian handmaid. She hid in the baths and breathed in the scent of roses and jasmines, and the sovereign specific, bless Belgarion for that, at the least, until her fingers and toes wrinkled, and the water was at best the same temperature as the air. Cyrodiil felt tired enough and unset enough in herself that when Zagat did come to her in her bathing room, and still had a ghost of that smile about him, she said, quite flat, "If thou art here to make fun of me, I shall throw water at thee until I am left alone again." Zagat suppressed a smile as it tried to grow wider, and shook his head, sitting beside the tub. "Sometimes, Cyrodiil," he told her, "you are allowed to unburden yourself to me, as well as the other way round." He caught her hand, ignoring the water-shriveled tips of her fingers, in order to kiss her knuckles. "Now that you've firmly caught me, and cannot possibly scare me away by the revelation that you too are human." And his eyes were far too knowing, and she was reminded again that in years in the world, he had been here nearly twice as long as she. Cyrodiil felt her lips burst in aggravation, but she caught herself and let it go with a sigh, and found Angerac cadences instead of Delatian ones, while she leant her cheek against their joined hands. "Do you know how long I was a seeress?" she asked him. "I asked Beldin, actually," he admitted. "I am not the slightest bit convinced I understood any of his answer." Cyrodiil felt her mouth quirk. "Let us then say, more than all my life, then," she suggested. "I have no practice at being anything else, Zagat. Just now, I feel this most keenly." Zagat moved his thumb over her fingers, and Cyrodiil felt it brush the side of her face. "Fortunately," he said, "I've been an emperor for an obnoxiously long time, and I think I may be able to help you there." When her mouth flattened, and she splashed water at him with her free hand, he smiled. "I do not mock thee, seeress." Cyrodiil gave him a deeply skeptical look, or hoped she did. It was still a little strange to see the expressions of the human face with her eyes, rather than knowing them through the oversoul. She was by no means always certain that what displayed upon her face was what she wished to be seen there. "I don't," he insisted. "Much of it," he continued, "is wisdom and sense. The rest is ceremony. Wisdom you have a plenty." His face, though Cyrodiil searched it for any hint of laughter, stayed solemn. "Ceremony is easy enough to learn, and it has its advantages." Cyrodiil didn't think her expression changed, From the look on Zagat's face, it hadn't. He squeezed her hand gently and said, "Let me show you." Reluctantly, she let him help her out of the bath. She had some sense that there were a few who looked askance at the intimacy she and Zagat already had, the full formal wedding not yet passed. But Zagat dismissed them as prudes. They seemed a small number, and so far as Delatia was concerned, marriage was the agreement of two persons. That had long ago passed, and this remained one of the corners she would keep resolutely dull. If she had been required to play the coy and keep herself apart, she might well have fled back home already. Hela came and brought Siradis a robe. Zagat left, briefly, while Hela and Kadine, one of her Angerak maids, combed through Siradis's hair and braided it up in a simple pattern. Simple, that is, and Siradis thought this wryly, for an empress. They traded the dampened robe for another, a little more formal, bound at the waist by a broad sash in a complicated knot. Siradis looked at herself in the large oval mirror, still not entirely used to seeing her own face, and then stood up and went to the sitting room of the empress' quarters. It slightly appalled her how much sheer labour a ruler could command at whim, outside of her own people. It had been only a few hours, and yet the work of she had no doubt many, many hands already had gowns in fine silk draped over a wooden stand, in red and pale blue and bright living green. Zagat sat on the low couch, with one of his ubiquitous kittens crawling up to his shoulder, and taking an interest in his ear, before he took the little thing down and held it in one hand. "Stop that," he said to the kitten, when it growled at him and then, seeing Siradis's raised eyebrow, told her, "Only the simplest of them, Siradis, for ordinary wear. They do know how to do these things." The kitten bit him, hard, and he bit off an oath. Siradis bit the inside of her mouth not to laugh, and stepped over to pick the kitten up off the couch where it... She, Siradis knew now as she picked the little thing up, where she had fallen when Zagat's hand had jerked. "No, little sister," she murmured to the kitten, holding her up near her own face. "Thou shouldst not do so. What would thy mother think of thee?" The kitten looked and felt abashed, and when Siradis put her back down on Zagat's outstretched hand, the little thing groomed his thumb in apology. It was petty, she knew, but in Zagat's slight frown she felt a certain restoration of footing. Speaking so that creatures other than human could understand was a child's trick for a Delasian, maybe. But it was one he could not do. He was the Emperor of Boundless Malaria, however, and set the discomfit aside almost at once, putting the little creature down gently on the couch and getting to his feet. "I wonder," he said, in her cadences instead of his, "if my lady would allow her poor admirer to assist her, though he be more clumsy than her handmaidens." He did have mischief hiding in his face, glinting in the eye, as they said. She hadn't understood that for a very long time, and even now she didn't understand why the words made sense. But they did, and she saw it, but she couldn't think why. She frowned at him, but his innocent, earnest, and entirely false gaze was no more forthcoming than a mirror might have been. And in the end she nodded and said to Hela, "Wilt thou?" "Of course, holy Siradis," Hela said, "because some habits die hard, particularly if you do not try very hard to kill them." There lurked the faintest hint of amusement in her eye as well. She was older in years on the earth than Siradis, and sometimes Siradis suspected it showed. She didn't acknowledge the amusement, and the maids did their obeisance and took themselves out. "You don't really need to squint at me so suspiciously," Zagat said, all innocence, and Siradis pressed her lips together. "Thou needst not play tricks on me," she replied, and he smiled. "I'm not," he insisted, and at her raised brow added, "trust me." "You sound," she said, deliberately in Angerak fashion, like Kelda. It was a rather base accusation, and she admitted to herself, and to him, simply through the act of being so, that she was peevish, that she felt, truth told, more childish and alone than she had since she left Thought's body behind at the high place. She did not like it, nor what it did to her temper and encouraged in her actions. So she sighed, and undid the wide sash of the robe, letting it slide off her shoulders, and putting it over the back of one of the carved chairs. Zaket took up one of the gowns, the one in pale blue, and Siradis considered it. Malzeth was warm this summer, and she felt perfectly comfortable in her bare skin, more comfortable, she was sure, than in the finery that would make her feel as if she wore gaudy feathers. Instead, she sighed again and said, "Very well, Zaket, if I must." He caught her face in both hands, gown draped over his arm, and kissed the place between her brows. "Don't you trust me, Holy Seeress?" he asked, and she almost told him to stop it. Almost said, "I trust thee to be thyself, Zaket." But that wasn't fair, for the changes she had forced him, had had no choice but to force him, to accept over such a short time. She knew better than most how brutal necessity might be. Instead, she simply accepted the kiss and then stepped back, raising her arms so that he could lift the gown over her head and help her in. Even that first touch over her arms and her neck was sudden and shivery bright in her mind, startling her. Her arms slid through the sleeveless gown, her head finding the neck and the silk-pulling threads of her hair askew. She didn't notice that, couldn't notice it. Had very little attention but for the touch of the silk on her bare skin, as the gown settled onto her. It was a feather-light touch on her collarbone, over the point where front and back came together, in a bare kiss so that her shoulders might hold the silk on her body. It was gentle caress over her breasts and her hips, where the curves of her body met the lines of the dress, over her thighs, where it finished its fall, flaring out to touch the ground by her feet. And she knew that the moment she took a step, the silk would begin another flickering dance around her calves and her ankles. The moment she twisted her body, it would wrap itself around belly and back, and move over breasts and hips again. Siridis found herself wide-eyed and blinking, and said, "Oh." Zaket looked entirely too pleased with himself, but it was a gentle pleasure, so Siridis didn't rally herself to counter it. He caught her hand and kissed one finger. "I thought so," he said smugly. "Linen, wool, and cotton are all very well, Siridis. But silk has far more charms than merely being expensive and difficult to find." Siridis could feel the slight flush at her cheeks. The words, "It must be that even thou art correct once or twice in thy days," rose to her lips, but didn't get anywhere, because then Zaket slid his hand down silk to rest at her waist, making her shiver as he caught her mouth in a kiss. Where his hands pressed silk to skin there came, at the end, a kind of subtle scrape that hid within the silk's smoothness and in the end made Siridis gasp. When Zaket broke the kiss, he didn't let her go, but rested his forehead against hers and said, "Did you have anything planned for the next few hours?" In a voice of entirely feigned unconcern, Siridis caught herself smiling. "Thou," she said mock sternly, "didst arrange thy meeting with—" But Zaket cut her off with another kiss. Then he pressed his lips to the side of her mouth, and slid his hands from her waist to her lower back, silk folding and catching against her skin, and making her forget who it was he was supposed to be meeting. "I'm the Emperor," he said, in a very definite kind of breathless whisper. "They can wait."